A Contra podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Contra AI. Welcome you to the deep dive. Today, we're taking on something. Well, it's less a book and more like an intellectual time bomb. David Hume's A Treatise of Human Nature.
That's a great way to put it. It's definitely unsettling stuff.
Right, because it fundamentally messes with how you think you think. It's not just history, it feels very current.
Absolutely. And Hume's ambition here was just monumental. He literally wanted to do for us, for humans, what Isaac Newton did for physics.
Like find the underlying laws.
Exactly. A comprehensive science of man, applying that same empirical observation-based method to, you know, psychology, how we think, even morality.
A science of man. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, so it's this huge old book. Why should you care about it right now?
Well, because Hume drops this bombshell. Maybe our most fundamental beliefs, like knowing who you are or that the sun will rise tomorrow or even what's right and wrong. Maybe they aren't built on solid, rational ground.
You mean they're built on?
On habit, custom, feelings. Yeah. It's a massive challenge to that whole idea of humans as these purely logical creatures.
Okay, so who is this guy, David Hume?
He lived from 1711 to 1776, a key figure in the Scottish Enlightenment and really the peak of British empiricism, building on thinkers like Locke and Berkeley.
And he really wanted to be that Newton of the moral sciences, didn't he? Like, discover the basic laws of our mental world.
He absolutely did. And to pull that off, he had to be incredibly skeptical, really analytical.
Unafraid to rock the boat.
Totally. He wasn't tied down by the usual academic or religious thinking of his time. So if his logic led him somewhere uncomfortable, like, say, questioning the existence of a permanent soul or some divine plan, he just went there.
I heard the treatise didn't exactly fly off the shelves initially.
Huh. No, it famously fell dead-born from the press, as he put it. But the ideas were so powerful, they eventually couldn't be ignored. They famously woke Immanuel Kant from his dogmatic slumber, basically changing philosophy forever.
So let's get into the mechanics. How does his science of man actually work? What's the starting point?
It starts simple, but it's devastatingly effective. Everything in your mind, absolutely everything, has to come from experience, from your senses. That's the only way in.
No innate ideas or divine downloads.
Nope. It all boils down to two types of mental stuff, what he calls perceptions. First, you've got impressions.
Okay, what are those?
Impressions are the vivid, forceful things you experience right now. The feeling of the chair you're sitting on, the sound of my voice, maybe a pang of hunger. Direct, immediate sensations and emotions.
Got it. Direct experience. What's the second type?
Ideas. These are the fainter copies of impressions. They're what you use when you're thinking, remembering, imagining.
So the impression is the real-time feeling. The idea is like the echo or the memory of it.
Precisely. And this distinction, the copy principle, becomes his ultimate analytical tool.
How so? Like a test?
Exactly like a test. If someone throws out some big abstract concept, say, substance or innate justice, Hume asks, okay, show me the impression. Where is the direct sensory experience this idea is copied from?
And if you can't trace it back to a real sensation or feeling,
then Hume suggests maybe that idea is empty. Maybe it's just philosophical jargon without real meaning.
Ouch. Okay, I can see how that would dismantle a lot of old philosophy.
It does. He uses it to deconstruct everything, showing that the world we think we know, the stable world, is actually built by the non-rational habitual parts of our minds.
So he tears it down. Does he build anything back up?
Yes, but on a totally different foundation. Not logic, but nature. Passion, sentiment, the way we actually are. And the scope is huge. The treatise covers knowledge, emotions, and morality across its three books.
All right, let's dive into the really big shocks, the three claims that still make people argue today. Let's start with book one, Knowledge, and how Hume attacks our sense of certainty about the world.
Right. He lays out what's called Hume's fork. Basically, anything we claim to know fits into one of two bins.
Okay, bin number one.
Relations of ideas, think math, logic, stuff like 2 + 2 = 4, or all bachelors are unmarried. These are certain, true by definition, but they don't actually tell us anything new about the world itself.
They're just about how we define things. What's bin number two?
Matters of fact. This is everything else. Everything we learn through experience. You know, fire is hot, the sky is blue, dropping things makes them fall.
This sounds like most of what we think we know.
It is, but here's the kicker. Hume says knowledge from matters of fact can never be truly certain.
Never. Why not? Even something like the sun rising tomorrow.
Especially something like that. It comes down to how we understand causation. cause and effect.
Okay, explain. We see cause and effect everywhere.
We think we do. We believe there's a necessary connection between a cause and its effect. Like when one billiard ball hits another, the first one makes the second one move. We feel that necessity.
Yeah, seems obvious.
But Hume says, look closer. What do you actually perceive with your senses? You see one ball moving, then touching the other, contiguity. You see the first event happen right before the second priority.
Okay.
And you've seen this same sequence happen over and over again, constant conjunction.
Right. So what's missing?
The necessity. You yeah. never actually see or feel the necessary link itself. You don't perceive the making part, the force, the power connecting them.
Well, so all our confidence that hitting the cue ball will move the other ball, that's not based on seeing the necessity.
According to Hume, no. It's based entirely on custom or habit. Because you've seen it happen countless times, your mind develops an expectation, a feeling.
Psychological feeling, not a logical certainty.
Exactly. It's an internal feeling of determination that we project onto the world. And this leads straight to the famous problem of induction.
Which
basically says there's no purely rational, logical reason to believe the future must resemble the past. Just because the sun rose every day before doesn't logically guarantee it will rise tomorrow. Our certainty is just a very strong habit.
Wow. Okay, that definitely pulls the rug out from under scientific certainty. What's the second big shock? You mentioned the self.
Yeah, this one might be even more personal, more unsettling for some. Hume applies the same skeptical method inward. He asks, what is this self we all feel we have? This stable, continuous me.
Right. I feel like there's a core me that's been the same throughout my life.
Hume challenges you to find it. Look inside right now. Try to catch that unchanging self, that core essence. What do you actually find?
Thoughts, feelings, sensations, memories popping up.
Exactly. All you ever encounter, he argues, is a constant stream of these fleeting perceptions. Thoughts, emotions, sensations, always changing, always in flux.
There's no single stable thing that is me.
He famously described the self as nothing but a bundle or collection of different perceptions which succeed each other with an inconceivable rapidity and are in a perpetual flux and movement.
A bundle? Like just a pile of experiences tied together?
Kind of. Imagine a river. It looks like one continuous thing, but the water making it up is constantly changing. Hume thinks the self is like that. It's the flow, the succession, linked by memory and imagination that creates the illusion of a fixed thing.
If I'm just a different bundle of perceptions from moment to moment, how can society hold me responsible for something I did years ago that was a different bundle?
That's a great question. Hume would say our ideas of identity and responsibility aren't based on some deep metaphysical truth about a permanent soul. They're social constructs.
Constructs, meaning?
Meaning they're useful fictions we create. We use memory and social conventions to link the bundles together because society needs that continuity to function for promises, laws, cooperation. It's about utility, not reality.
Okay, my head is spinning a bit. Yeah. Let's move to the third shock. This one's about motivation and morality.
Right. So after showing reason can't give us certainty about the world or the self, Hume asks, what actually makes us do things? What drives our actions?
Most philosophers before him would have said reason, right?
Mm-hmm.
We figure out the best thing to do and then do it.
Exactly. But Hume flips it completely. He says reason is purely instrumental. It's like a calculator. It can figure out the best way to get something, but it can't tell you what you should want in the first place.
So what it does tell us what to want?
The passions, our emotions, desires, feelings, values. And this leads to maybe his most famous, most provocative statement.
Let me guess. Reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions.
Yes. And can never pretend to any other office than to serve and obey them. Boom.
Slave of the passions. That's intense.
It really is. Think about it. For centuries, the goal was for reason to rule over the messy emotions. Hume says, nope. It's the other way around. Your desire for, say, coffee sets the goal. Reason just figures out the steps to the coffee shop.
Okay, if reason doesn't set our goals and passion does, what does that mean for morality? Isn't morality supposed to be rational?
Not according to Hume. If reason can't tell us what we ought to value, then moral judgments can't be based on logic either.
So where do they come from? Divine command?
Nope. He grounds morality in moral sentiment. Basically, a feeling. We feel a sense of pleasure or approval when we contemplate actions or character traits that are useful or agreeable, either to the person themselves or to others.
We feel good about good things.
In a nutshell, yes.
Yeah.
And things like justice, he argues, aren't some eternal truth. They're artificial virtues.
Artificial. meaning man-made.
Exactly. They arise out of social convention, out of necessity. We invent rules like property rights and promise keeping because we live in a world of scarcity and we're not always naturally generous. We need these rules to cooperate and survive. They're useful.
But why would I care about rules that benefit society, not just me?
Ugh, that's where sympathy comes in. Hume believes we have an innate capacity to share or feel the sentiments of others. When we see someone benefiting from a just action, sympathy allows us to feel a flicker of their pleasure, which reinforces our approval of justice.
So morality is rooted in feeling, usefulness, and our ability to connect with others' feelings.
That's the naturalistic picture Hume paints. It's all very human.
Okay, so we've gone through the skepticism about cause, self, and reason's role.
Yeah.
What are the big takeaways, the lasting lessons we should pull from this incredibly dense work?
Well, theme one has got to be the primacy of experience. That copy principle isn't just abstract philosophy. It's a practical BS detector.
How so?
If someone starts using really grand abstract terms, maybe in politics, maybe in advertising, maybe even self-help, ask yourself, what concrete experience does this connect back to? Can I feel it, see it, touch it in some way? If not, maybe be skeptical.
Right. Trace it back to the impression. Okay, what's theme two?
The limits of reason. This is huge. It fosters intellectual humility. Realizing that our deepest convictions about how the world works are often based on habit, not logic, should make us less dogmatic.
Less certain that we have all the answers.
Exactly. Reason is amazing for math and logic puzzles, but for predicting the messy, contingent world with absolute certainty, Hume says it's not the right tool for the job.
Okay, theme three. This sounds important for ethics.
It is. It's the I-ought distinction. Hume noticed philosophers would describe how things are in the world, say, people pursue power and then suddenly leap to saying how things ought to be, therefore pursuing power is good, or therefore we ought to resist power.
And Hume says you can't make that leap logically.
Correct. You can't derive a value judgment ought purely from a factual description. Just because something is a certain way doesn't mean it should be that way. This forces us to justify our moral values on other grounds, like sentiment, utility, shared goals, not by pretending they're just facts.
That feels very relevant today. And the last theme.
The social nature of psychology. Our sense of self, our moral compass, our understanding of justice. These aren't things we figure out alone in a vacuum. They are built through interaction, through society, driven by our shared feelings and the practical need to get along.
We construct ourselves and our world together.
A very real sense, yes. Driven by sentiment and cooperation.
The treatise is packed with memorable lines that really capture these ideas. Let's revisit a few key ones.
Definitely. That quote about reason and passion is probably the most famous.
Reason is, and ought only to be, the slave of the passions. It just completely flips the power dynamic we usually assume in our own heads. Goals come from feeling. Logic is just the helper.
Then there's the description of the self. Nothing but a bundle or collection of different perceptions. It's such a vivid image. It challenges that idea of a fixed, unchanging core, an immortal soul, maybe. It suggests we're more like a process, a flow.
Less statue, more river.
Exactly. And for causation, while there isn't one single quote quite as punchy, the core idea is that our feeling of necessary connection between cause and effect isn't perceived out there in the world. It comes from an internal feeling, born from habit.
So causation is really a psychological projection onto events. We feel the necessity because we expect it.
That's the essence of it. It's a powerful reframing.
Okay, this is all fascinating, maybe a bit mind-bending. How can you actually apply this centuries-old skepticism in your life today?
I think the first, most direct application is fostering intellectual humility and flexibility. Recognize when your confidence in something, maybe a business strategy, a personal belief, even just how things are done, is based purely on, well, it's always been this way.
That's the habit Hume talked about.
Right. And recognizing it as habit, not logic, opens you up to change, to new evidence, to being less rigid.
That connects to the second application, critical thinking, especially now in the digital age.
Oh, absolutely. Hume's distinction between constant conjunction, correlation, and necessary connection, causation, is vital. We're flooded with data showing things happening together.
X goes up and Y goes up.
Yeah. And the immediate temptation is to assume X causes Y. Hume trains you to hit the brakes and ask, is there really a necessary link here? Or are they just correlated? It's crucial for evaluating news, health claims, everything.
Don't mistake correlation for causation. Got it. What else?
Well, think about better decision-making, especially influencing others or yourself. If Hume's right that passion drives action,
then appeals just to logic might not work.
Exactly. If you want to lead a team, market a product, or even just change your own habits, you probably need to connect with the underlying desires, values, and emotions first.
Yeah.
Then bring in reason to figure out the how. You need the emotional engine.
Makes sense. Appeal to the heart, then the head, and the last application.
Fostering empathy. Grounding morality in sympathy isn't just a theory, it's a practice. It suggests that being a good person is less about memorizing rules and more about actively cultivating our ability to understand and share the feelings of others.
Mm-hmm. It makes ethics more about connection and understanding.
Precisely. It's about tuning into that shared human experience.
So, wrapping this up, what's your big takeaway from diving back into Hume?
For me, it's the profound, almost humbling reevaluation of what it means to be human. We aren't flawed angels striving for pure reason. We're complex creatures powerfully shaped by instinct, habit, and feeling. And maybe that's okay. Maybe understanding that helps us build lives and societies that actually work with our nature instead of constantly fighting against it.
Yeah, working with the grain. What surprised me most revisiting this was actually finding the bundle theory kind of liberating.
Liberating? How so?
Well, if the self isn't this fixed, predetermined thing, if it really is just a constantly changing collection of experiences and habits, then that means change isn't just possible, it's fundamental. We have this incredible freedom to consciously shape the bundle going forward, to grow, to reinvent.
That's a really positive spin on what many find terrifying. I like that. Actively curating your bundle.
Yeah. So the final provocative thought for you, the listener, to take away. Consider this. Hume compels us to see that the reliable, orderly world we navigate every day, the world of solid objects, predictable causes, shared moral duties, isn't necessarily handed down from on high or dictated by pure logic. In a very deep way, it might be a world constructed by the amazing, sometimes messy, but ultimately necessary workings of our own human nature.
A world built by us from the inside out.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.